I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books on political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Lisa Wedeen, Mary R. Morton Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago. We're discussing her 2019 book, Authoritarian Apprehensions, Ideology, Judgment, and Mourning in Syria from the University of Chicago Press. Wedeen's work is at the intersection of political theory, political science, and anthropology, and she works on culture, political ethnography, and ideology. She is the author of a previous book on Syria, as well as one on Yemen, and is the author of many articles on a range of topics, including liberalism, judgment, and meaning. So first of all, Lisa Wedeen, let me say welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Lisa, I love the book. It's about the concept of authoritarianism as explored through a particular case study of Syria. And I found it to be, you know, social science of the best kind, which is not driven by numbers, but the kind of in-depth knowledge of the region that incorporates a lot of political theory into the analysis. So thank you for the book, first of all.
Thank you.
And let me ask you first, I typically tend to start off by asking about the motivation for the book. And I'm particularly interested in why you wrote this book. You had a previous book also about Syria. So maybe you could say a little bit about why you revisited this region, this country, and maybe say a little bit about why Syria in the first place, how you came to be interested in this country.
Yeah, well, I actually visited more in touristic mode, but as a young student in 1985, and fell in love with the place, and also realized that many of my political theory aspirations and interests would be well served by thinking more deeply about issues of, in that instance, domination and resistance, as you said, the kind of complexities of authoritarian rule, and also the ways in which ideology matters for our thinking about issues of power. And so I was there really almost by fluke in 1985, and I took language classes and was so captivated by the country that I came back on a first Fulbright in 88-89, lived in the dormitories, I was enrolled in the history program, and began thinking about dissertation topics. That dissertation became my first book, Ambiguities of Domination. That book actually really looked at flagrantly fictitious claims and ask the question, why bother with rituals of obeisance that are transparently phony? No one believes that the then president, Hafez al-Assad, is the first pharmacist, or that he wins elections by 99.2% of the vote, or that he'll live forever. So social science basically had two responses to the extent that they would ever even ask that question. One was politics is about material interests and the groups articulating it. So this stuff is basically epiphenomenal. But in the context of Syria and many other countries, in fact, both post-colonial, post-revolutionary regimes, but other ones such as more so-called totalitarian ones, that's not a term I embrace, like, but for example, like Nazi Germany or Stalinist Soviet practices, these kinds of regimes often spend resources on flagrantly fictitious sorts of or patently spurious modes or techniques of social control, rather than, say, punitive inducements or in addition to punitive and instrumental inducements, in addition, in other words, to carrots and sticks. So thinking of politics simply as being about material interests also doesn't answer the question as to why regimes spend scarce resources on these kinds of symbolic displays of power. Then, of course, there was another group of social scientists and political theorists who do take language seriously and basically say, no, this is about producing legitimacy, or in anthropology, it's more hegemony. But legitimacy and hegemony as concepts presuppose emotional commitment. And these flagrantly fictitious claims or these rituals of obeisance that are transparently phony can't be doing that exactly. So I made a different kind of argument, very beholden in that work to Foucault. I argued that no, these flagrantly fictitious claims are actually enforcing obedience, inducing complicity, structuring the terms within which a certain kind of resistance can happen, atomizing people from one another, because I know that you know that he's not the first pharmacist, but I don't know what you do think, at least in public. And taking political materials that had been adhered to or taken with some seriousness and rendering them absurd over time. So that was that book. And when I went back to Syria after an absence of over a decade, I was surprised to see how much had changed and how much remained familiar. And so I intended, this was in 2010, I intended to write a book that grappled with the seeming emergence of a kinder, gentler version of autocracy under President Bashar al-Assad, who began his rule after the father in 2000. And among the issues I had imagined exploring were the forms of generational change that were both a product and a driver of market openings. The new aesthetic imaginaries of everyday life accompanying the marked embrace of consumption and departure from Soviet-era styles of insularity and asceticism. And the palpable support Bashar al-Assad seemed to be garnering from communities that had hitherto withheld it from the regime, including some former dissidents, artists, urban professionals, and members of the clergy. And while I was there, the uprising in Tunisia began, registering grievances and really animating hopes for the end of tyrannies throughout the Arab world, inspiring then subsequent large-scale protests in Egypt, Yemen, Libya, Bahrain, and of course Syria. And I was still in Damascus when the uprising began in Syria in March 2011, and I left toward the end of May, by which time indications of the regime's intransigence and also indications of the troubles besetting multiple oppositions had already become too glaring to ignore. So authoritarian apprehensions, ideology, judgment, and mourning in Syria is the book that resulted. And it does remain keyed to my initial interests in authoritarian resilience and political change. And that those are, as you mentioned earlier, Jeff, abiding concerns to political scientists, while also then exploring important issues currently under debate in political theory and anthropology. So it was focused and remains focused on the complexities of ideological uptake and the processes of recruitment into what I had decided pre-uprising to call Syria's neoliberal autocracy. So the book then became increasingly inflected by the extraordinary rush of events, first by the revolutionary exuberance of the initial days of unrest, and then by the devastating violence that with terrible speed shattered hopes of any quick undoing of dictatorship. So the book speaks to my decades-long engagement with Syria and Syrians, but it is even more than a book about authoritarianism per se. It's about the seductions of authoritarian rule, which I hope will speak to broader audiences that are interested in the ways in which, with a certain kind of neoliberal unraveling, forms of nativism, forms of ultra-right attractions to authoritarianism have become global. So that's one of the things that the book is doing. And in doing that, its main sort of concept is less authoritarianism per se, and more ideology and the way in which ideology matters.
Yeah, that's great. I want to get there and closer to the end, as far as because it struck me that a lot of what you say here in the book is much more widely applicable, as you just suggested, to the sort of moments that we find ourselves now in now. So I thought that was great and very, very illuminating. I wanted to start because this is, I wish actually more people would write books like this, which is truly interdisciplinary book. What's that?
That's very kind of you.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, it's a truly interdisciplinary book. I mean, as you suggest, you start with political theory, you go into history, you make contributions also to political science. I mean, it's great. I wonder if you could maybe say a little bit about how you approach such an interdisciplinary project, sort of just start with maybe some methodological issues. Because I tend to have on people who are more strictly in political theory. But you're speaking to not just to political theorists, but also to political scientists. And maybe you could say a little bit about the state of the field of a kind of qualitative political science. If there are others out there that are working in similar approaches that you do, how it fits sort of with other colleagues that are out there. I had on Sherry Berman, who several episodes ago, though her approach was a little bit different. Maybe you could say a little bit. I mean, as we all know, the discipline is still trending in the sort of quantitative direction and the materialist direction you saw in the 80s. It's still very much palpable now. So how do you connect your work to the who are your readers? Are they mostly political theorists, or do you get readers in comparative politics?
I do get readers in comparative politics, actually, a number. I think that this book, as opposed to, say, the first one I mentioned, Ambiguities of Domination about Syria, will be more difficult for them, in part because of the ways in which the discipline has moved, and in part because of the attention to political theory in this book, and also to the ways in which it is an intervention into anthropological literatures in social theory. Anthropology in particular has a much closer relationship to cultural Marxism than even political theory does at this point. So the book is meant to be a widely read among scholars who are interested in issues of authoritarianism, who are interested in issues of ideological uptake and uneven saturation, that are interested in issues of revolutionary exhilaration and disappointment, and in what Theodore Adorno called the otherwiseness. It could have been otherwise. Actually, he says it should have been otherwise of political commitment. It's also meant to be read by folks in cultural studies, people who are focused on affect theory, and people whose understandings of ideology are not only about content, but also about form. So you asked a bit about methodology, and in political science, there is a small but vigorous group of interpretive social scientists, many of whom I hope will read and learn from the book. And I'm in conversation. I've learned a great deal from them. I do hope that many people in political theory, and there is a new interest, I would say, within political theory, not only in comparative political theory, but also in political ethnographies. And I do hope to make a major intervention into thinking about how we understand the empirical world in relationship to our theorizing. So you asked me more specifically about methodology, and there I would say sort of three things. One, I do employ what I like to think of as a Foucauldian discourse analysis. What does that mean? It's basically two-pronged, or maybe even three-pronged, depending upon how you count. And the first prong is to look at the historical conditions of possibility for the production of the phenomenon under scrutiny. The second part is to look at the work the discourse does. And here, work is operates with two different meanings of work, or here, that's the two prong, if you will. Work is both the logic of the discourse, in other words, how are concepts relating to one another? What sorts of assumptions undergird the discourse? What kinds of effects? So that's the implications or the logic of the discourse. And then the other prong is the ramifications or the effects. What sorts of incitements to debate? What kinds of conversations? What sorts of institutional modalities shift as a result of the phenomenon or the discourse under scrutiny? So that's my methodological impulse comes from what I see as a certain attention to discourse and a certain way of thinking about discourse, both in terms of logic and effects and historical conditions or felicitous conditions of possibility. The other thing that, or another aspect, which is new to this book, actually, and is very important to what I'm trying to do here, is to understand all of the films and comedy skits and forms of popular culture that I'm discussing here, to think about those folks, those interlocutors, less as sort of people who generate artifacts that are evidence. They not only sort of attune us to implied audiences of artistic products, as important as these aspects are for cultural analysis, but they also generate possibilities for what Hannah Arendt called world-making. They are themselves political theorists in their own right, in other words. They operate beyond or in excess of referentiality and encourage the arts' evocatory functions. So the invitation in this book is to treat some Syrian artists as political theorists in their own right, interlocutors rather than informants, and their artifacts productive of possibilities for expanding the space of interpretive encounter in order to diagnose and see ways out of the impasses that I identify and that they identify collectively. So I put Hannah Arendt and Ludwig Wittgenstein, for example, into conversation with Osama Mohammed, the filmmaker, or Abu Nadara, the film collective.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I found that very interesting. I mean, you do a lot of analysis of art, of the comedy in the book, and the type of analysis you offer. It's not that these artists and comedians are just reflecting a particular, you know, geist, but they're actually engaging in sort of Hannah Arendtian action to sort of introduce something new. And I found that particularly compelling. And so I'd like to explore, you know, some of the, maybe you could give us some highlights there from the from the artists you examine. I wanted to start though, just by, maybe you could get us started by saying a little bit about the context of Syrian politics that can help sort of contextualize the argument. You already, in your introductory comments, talked about Bashar al-Assad's father, who was the ruler of the regime and the subject of your previous book, which I take it, again, I don't know much about Syria, but I take it he was much more of a, I guess, quote unquote, a traditional authoritarian ruler, whereas Bashar al-Assad had more of a, well, authoritarianism with a happy neoliberal face, at least before the Arab Spring came along. So I don't know if there's anything maybe you want to say about Syrian recent history to get us started. I'm not sure. You don't mention much about the sort of pre al-Assad regime. I don't know if much of the earlier history of Syria back to the Ottoman Empire or anything like that is relevant, but to just get us started in thinking about the recent history of Syrian politics.
Yeah, one of the things that I think is quite important to recognize here is that I want to make sure that I just want to go back to your other question for a moment, and then I'll add. But one thing I just want to be sure to acknowledge is that there are wonderful books about Syrian history. This is not one of them. It is, in part, many of people more qualified than I, historians in particular, and some political scientists have done excellent work, both Syrians and other folks from the region, as well as American and European social scientists have done excellent work on the history of Syria. I had no interest in duplicating that work. I really do begin here with the Bashar al-Assad era, which starts in 2000. Now, authoritarian rule in Syria was longstanding, and its stabilizing effects were entrenched, at least partially, by the late 1980s, with its neoliberal variant beginning gradually to emerge in the 1990s with selective economic reforms, which were followed by ambitious privatization initiatives, culminating in the official adoption in 2005 of what was euphemistically termed a social market economy. And it was devised by an emerging professional managerial elite that sounded a lot like the IMF with its language of good governance and stakeholders. And this social market economy involved encouraging private sector investment, stressing the virtues of individual philanthropy, and making provisions for offloading risk and responsibility onto civil society, or what they called civil society. So it cultivated private sector investment, and it celebrated the merits of private welfare, moreover, making for growing elective affinities between Syria's clergy with its historical roots in Syria's urban notable classes and regime-oriented crony capitalists. So the regime's turn toward the private sector by the 2000s, that's when this book kind of enters the picture, helps, I think, explain the divergent and fractured responses of Syria's clergy to the uprising and the relative quiescence of key religious leaders in both Damascus and historically rebellious Aleppo, something I get to in more detail in chapter one. But more broadly, in Syria in the 2000s, circles of privilege expanded and contracted at the same time, resulting in countervailing tendencies that congealed some differences. In other words, the gaps between rich and poor widened, but with more people appearing more prosperous in at least both major cities, both Damascus, the capital, and Aleppo, the commercial hub. The regime also produced new bases for both inclusion and exclusion. So access to information technologies, increased possibilities for travel, and an expanding circle of financial and social networks reflected in what interests me in the first family's exemplification of cosmopolitan living and a growing familiarity with urbane tastes, if not necessarily the means to indulge them. These were the kinds of everyday or quotidian novelties that constituted an important shift from Hafez al-Assad, the father, who ruled from 1970 to 2000, to Bashar, the son. So introducing some measure of economic reform and playing catch up in the magazine glossies with global trends were only part of what changed and part of what the book tracks. The professional managerial elite broadened to include global advertising's local subsidiaries and members of Syria's regionally successful celebrity conscious drama community, and I spend a lot of time on them. The latter could be called on to produce messages celebrating a modernity that performed both on and off screen a version of the good life, to borrow Lauren Berlant's term, consonant with the one being exemplified by the regime. And so in the book, in exploring the limits of rebellion and the seductions of status quo conventionality, Authoritarian Apprehensions shows how the Syrian regime managed to produce what I call, for lack of a better term, a silent majority of citizens invested in stability and fearful of alternatives. And that's what the book is in part about. So in back to Berlant for a moment, following her and thinking about the good life, I'm not only talking about aspirations to economic prosperity or well-being, but also fantasies of multicultural accommodation and a secure, sovereign, pride-inducing national identity. And it's these visions and inducements to compliance in the first decade of President Bashar al-Assad's rule, which were importantly unevenly saturating and in flux, that defined the terms in which neoliberal autocracy was created, sustained, and in the context of the uprising, ultimately reconfigured. So neoliberal autocracy is a very important aspect of the book, charting both its emergence in the early 2000s and also its unraveling in the context of the uprising.
Yeah, and this is a great overview, especially the first chapter, and when you take on this notion of neoliberal autocracy, which I found to be a quite an interesting notion. I just had a Wendy Brown a couple episodes ago,
terrific podcast.
Actually. Oh, thank you. Yeah, it was quite interesting the way it's intersperses itself into Syrian politics. So this was quite interesting. I wanted to ask, one of the central concepts you use in that chapter and sort of goes throughout the book. Maybe you can say a little bit about the argument of that chapter by way of talking a little bit about your use of the term ideology, which you use in maybe a non-traditional way, I would say. I mean, there's a kind of, as you say, affective component that comes with ideology. So maybe you could say a little bit about it by way of contrasting it with the traditional Marxist approach to it, and how it sort of supports the neoliberal autocracy of Bashar al-Assad's regime.
Great. Thanks so much. I appreciate that question immensely, because the book really, more than anything, wants to repurpose the concept of ideology for the present. And in doing so, it moves beyond Althusserian understanding. It's very indebted to Althusser's understanding of ideological interpolation, in other words, new ways of hailing citizens into Syria's autocratic system. But it also attempts to think about ideology as it works through seduction, arousing fantasy content while simultaneously diffusing it and smoothing out contradictions. And so I see ideology as helping to manage collective anxieties and sociological or socio-political, rather, incompatibilities by providing mechanisms that allow dissonances to be contained, disavowed, and displaced. And here I am very indebted to the work of Slavoj Žižek and Frederick Jameson, among others. And part of what they helped me to do, and of course, they're also very influenced by Althusser. But what they helped me to do is to see ideology not simply in terms of its content, not simply, say, in the way that many social scientists understand ideology as a discrete doctrine or a dogma. That would be a kind of Weberian understanding, not simply as ideational, but rather as form, working in particular ways. And the book really emphasizes ideology as form in three ways. Ideology works as containment, it works as displacement, and it works as disavowal. So, as containment, ideology operates by making what are essentially social and historical anxieties seem natural and inevitable, gratifying desires largely to the extent that they're kept in check. So this containment also works through modes of hyper-identification. In other words, we can fantasize about images of celebrity glamour or elegance or composure or whatever, without necessarily believing that we will ever be able to emulate adequately the exemplar. So it smooths out contradictions in that way. Ideology also works as displacement, in which unbearable fears are relocated onto a new object, allaying anxieties by transferring unacceptable attributes onto a fantasy other. So examples of this: conspiracies of national undoing that put terrorists at the heart of the problem, or projections of in-group violence outward. And this is certainly not specific to Syria. I speak about it at length in chapter 5, but many of my interlocutors there are theorists in the West, as well as Syrian theorists, because there is such profound overlap. So processes of displacement, which in tandem with containment and disavowal, were working frequently to help organize collective life in Syria's authoritarian circumstances, but again, are not specific to Syria. But the most interesting part of, I think, the three points I want to make here around ideology as form is the way ideology operates as disavowal. So the famous theorist Octave Manoni noticed how people would rationalize their lives, acknowledging and disavowing simultaneously. So the phrase, "I know very well and yet nevertheless," exemplifies this mode of disavowal. It's a distancing from accountability that has implications for politics. So in the case of Syria, the disavowal typically worked like this, or works like this. "I know very well that the regime is incorrigibly corrupt, and yet nevertheless we can build government-sponsored civil society organizations that truly empower citizens." Or, "I know very well that there is no going back to the way things were before the war, and yet everything will resolve itself as easily as biting into a zucchini. That's a Syrian phrase, adit huseye. Or, taking an example to be explored, I hope, with you a little bit more here, is "I know very well that Sunni gangs did not visit our village in the night, and yet nevertheless they could have." Or, "Among secular activists in the first 2 years of the uprising, I know very well that there are violent Islamic militants among the opposition, but nevertheless they're not really a problem, or I'll act as if they don't exist." So disavowal, interestingly enough, goes beyond denial, in that the problem calling for judgment is at least posed. In disavowal, the power of ideology comes into especially bold relief in the book, with subjects hailed into a position where the realities that can no longer be denied can still be dismissed. So in this sense, disavowal expresses the contradiction it simultaneously repudiates.
You know, it's almost a matter of not taking responsibility in a way. I mean, I don't know if that simplifies it too much, but there's a certain acknowledgement of injustice, but not a not a recognition that citizens either must or are capable of taking responsibility for fixing it.
Well, sometimes it's about that. And chapter three, of course, deals with the issue of high speed, what I call high speed eventfulness, right, and the oversaturation of information and the ways in which that hobbles judgment, particularly in ways that could be read as not taking responsibility. But rather than being myself judgmental, given, you know, the kind of remarkable challenges that Syrians faced in overturning a dictatorship, I want to think about the ways that people can know things and not know them at the same time. That to me is very interesting. And that's very different than the kind of, I don't mean to be harsh on my first book, but the simplicity of my first book, the elegance maybe is a kinder way to put it in the first book, was that it was dealing with a very small subset of official rhetoric. That is to say, that group, the cult of personality, all of those flagrantly fictitious or patently spurious rituals of obeisance. This is dealing with a much broader set of discursive formations under the sign, and here we're talking about content now, neoliberal autocracy, that worked in a way to allow those in the ambivalent middle to suspend judgment or to work within siloed publics, to produce a kind of echo chamber that allowed people to hear what they were already hearing or to confirm beliefs they already had. But having said that, I do want to appreciate that even in these modes of disavowal or inattention or an attention that is partial, many of us in many different kinds of circumstances work in this way all of the time, in part because life can be difficult, if not unbearable. And so to some extent, the book is about genres of bearability in the context of overwhelming tumult. And in those contexts, we can know something and not know things in the same time, take on a kind of political importance that they might not have in other circumstances.
Yeah, so just to focus on that third chapter for a minute, which is on that the point that you just made about the oversaturation of information, and we'll come back to the second chapter too because it's about comedy, which I really liked. But the third chapter on the oversaturation of information, I mean, this is one of the many places in the book that has broader applicability. I mean, we're used to hearing now about fake news and you know, the many multifarious sources of news information in the modern age. And it strikes me that, you know, that tends to have two maybe different kinds of effects. And maybe you can say a little bit about how what your experience in Syria is under this regime, how this is related to these two. I mean, on the one hand, sometimes people just kind of throw up their hands and say, I don't know what's truth anymore because there's so many competing, contradictory sources of information, and moreover, many of them seem to be biased and self-interested. So there's a sort of almost despairing tendency that happens. On the other hand, there seems to be a kind of doubling down, right, with one source of information, you know, the sort of Fox News zealot or whatever, that's you know, this is the truth, and all the other ones are the fake approach. So maybe say a little bit about what you see, you know, vis-a-vis those maybe two different kinds of approaches in Syria.
Yes, great. So chapter three is actually one of my favorite chapters. And I started writing it actually before the current discussions of fake news reached what maybe their crescendo. I don't know if it could continue to animate us for a long time. But in the context of also what's coming out around fake news, our understandings of fake news, I had sort of three interventions I wanted to make as the chapter evolved in the context of both what was happening on the ground in Syria, but also more globally. And the first one is, and this also gets us to, of course, the subtitles Ideology, Judgment, and Mourning, and chapter three is very much about judgment as well as ideology. So firstly, in relationship to Syria, and this is a lesson that Syrian activists learned at tremendous cost, too much information may generate the very uncertainty that circulating it is intended to allay. Over the course of the uprising, the Syrian state's ideological apparatus, no longer able to brand the regime as a kinder, gentler version of autocracy, learned how to use conditions of fear and insecurity to counter human rights activists and citizen journalists' attempts to document the truth. So it disseminated its own claims and counterclaims and exploited the political inexperience of some of the fractious opposition. And the point in doing that wasn't that the regime was thereby able to establish its own authority over the facts, but it was repeatedly successful in sowing doubt among a variety of addressees about the nature of evidence as such, and the credibility of oppositional narratives. So its sowing of doubt was itself a powerful tool of social control, one we see operative in the American context as well. And secondly, as scholars of American politics have pointed out, information overload and the uncertainty it generates may induce, and Jeff, this is something you were bringing up as well, may induce people to seek out opinions reaffirming their own. And this tendency towards balkanization can lead to polarization, or what I call siloed publics. And of course, the internet, to take an oft-used example, tends to do this quite well by isolating folks into, or where people isolate themselves, or where the algorithm isolates you into echo chambers where people can relish the sound of stories they're telling themselves anyway, and the stories they tell themselves about the stories they tell themselves. But third, and this is a possibility that is less covered in literature that is beginning to think in social scientific or political theory terms about fake news. And this is something that the Syrian conflict illuminates, in particular, these conditions of generalized uncertainty make it easy for people to find alibis for avoiding commitment to judgment at all, for suspending their judgment. So in circumstances of information oversaturation, and you know, perhaps especially when feelings of present danger extrude what Brian Massumi calls a remainder of surplus threat, uncertainty can provide a seemingly potent rationale for inaction in contexts in which action might otherwise have seemed morally incumbent. Now, of course, in the context of the intensifying violence in Syria over the course of the uprising, reasons for hunkering down and staying safe overwhelm. But the book suggests that at the beginning, this recourse to non-judgment mattered. And this was something I discuss in chapter one. It put what came to be referred to as the gray people, this silent middle, Ramadin, in Arabic, the moderates, at odds with activists. It put them at odds with activists and ultimately with the project of political transformation. And so what I'm interested in is how this atmospherics of doubt nurtured a self-satisfied ambivalence justifying a political paralysis and withdrawal, particularly among the professional managerial elite and a subset of cultural producers. And this variety of political resignation was an issue in the early years of Syria's neoliberal autocracy, as we saw in chapter two, or as I discuss in chapter two, in reference to sanctioned comedies, which served both to uphold the existing order and to incubate an oppositional consciousness. And so in the context of outright protest, the professional managerial elite silence helped, I want to argue, the regime navigate and prevail, at least, you know, at the time of the book's writing, amid the changing circumstances of its rule.
And it was also, I mean, sort of American journalists, too. And that, I mean, your example was great, which is the chemical weapons attack and... When was that, 2013?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, okay.
21st, 2013.
Yeah, and, you know, so the sort of article in the New York Times by Seymour Hersh, which you talk about, which sort of raised doubts about this. I wanted to ask a sort of broader question about this, you know, sort of beyond the Syrian example, which is something like the blunt question, what's to be done about some this? Because, I mean, I think of this in the this kind of phenomenon in the context, you know, Nietzsche in The Use and Disadvantage of History for Life sort of anticipates a lot of this, which is in the modern age, all the sort of horizons of knowledge have been exploded, and we're entering into an age of, well, what we've just been referring to as an oversaturation of information, that what he would think of as the sort of end of horizons. And that leads in his mind to a sort of enervation of action, mm-hmm. right? Because you're given so much information, you have to sort of process it. And it's very difficult to know what to do. And anytime you want to proceed with some kind of action, you're beset by 10 different kinds of doubts. And so I guess the question is, for those of us, say, on the side of reason, or we want to be on the side of enlightenment or something like that, how can we combine that sort of commitment with also a commitment to political action, as they seem to be in tension with one another? Or is it easy to sort of fall into a tribal, you know, retrieve the horizon, like closed horizon, like Nietzsche talks about, and just cast off the fake news and so forth? But I think it's a little bit tougher for those of us, right? You know, I mean, I read the New York Times this morning, and, you know, it sows doubts about this and that. So I don't know if you have any thoughts about that as a sort of, you know, if this is a broader lesson and sort of how to combat that tendency in regimes to exacerbate this kind of problem.
Well, I think that there are a number of ways in which Syrians themselves are working the weaknesses of their current system, current systems, I should say, both the challenges for those in exile or those who have been displaced internally, and for those who are living under authoritarianism in ways that where they're unevenly related to the regime's efforts at re-seizing control. And it does seem to me that there are revolutionary comedies, for example, that are attempting to generate solidarity by producing a kind of collaborative knowability, a sense of shared project, if you will, through irreverence. Alenka Zupančič notes that, and she's a kind of a Zizekian, Lacanian political theorist, notes that comedy works when it leads us away from the actual direction from which the punchline comes, and emphasizing the effect of surprise upon which the joke depends. And so surprise is a key element of joke telling, and she's focusing on the joke here, but I don't necessarily think it's specific to the joke, she's very Lacanian, but for better and for worse. But one doesn't have to be Lacanian to understand that the comedic form reliance on the unexpected, its embrace of things like misrecognition, the temporal inversion of satisfaction before demand, the attunement to retroactive fixity, and the call to attend to aspects of ordinary life to which we are generally inattentive, as well as the spirit of open-ended play, all point to the struggle between our desires and our attachments. And this is something that Syrian comedians, particularly revolutionary comedians, bring to our attention or place into bold relief. Comedy, as Lauren Berlantigan and Sion Knight have argued very forcefully, enable the very contradictions and stresses to which they also point. And so at times, there's nothing necessarily revolutionary about comedy, but at times they invite us to think collectively in more open-ended ways, in part by cultivating an attunement to and a reverence toward convention. So it is one of the genres I talk about that summons us to an otherwiseness of commitment, to again invoke Theodore Adorno, to the theories, in other words, and the creative genres with the capacity to conjure the coming into being of political activity, if not necessarily a novel political program, in the present. So I want to suggest that comedies are one way in which we see political action through speech in the present. But there are other ways as well. And particularly in the chapter three, so the comedy chapter is chapter two, but particularly in chapter three, when I'm discussing fake news, there are also efforts to circumvent the challenges of fake news, not by producing straightforward documentaries, for example, although there are those important efforts as well, but also to counteract a kind of systemic violence that is part and parcel of high-speed eventfulness and the sheer velocity with which information is transmitted and apprehended in the internet age, whether in authoritarian circumstances or in nominally liberal democratic ones as well, by generating I talk a lot about Abu Nagara in this chapter, an anonymous film collective, by generating a kind of frame-breaking narrative that these are very short films that function almost like debris that can be repurposed, shards that cut through the impasse of fake news by bypassing the very structure of journalistic publicity and claims to objectivity that are so central to conventional documentary genres. There's a third way that, one other example of the way I'm seeing a kind of political otherwiseness develop is in ways that are consonant with and speak to Hannah Arendt's important discussion of representative thinking. And here, filmmakers like Osama Muhammad, in his controversial film, Silvered Water, it seems to me, are producing the kind of polyphonic narrative voicing that allow us to imagine yourself in a place that you are not. In other words, not to conform by counting noses and joining a majority, not by being hyper-identified with suffering, with a kind of danger of the sort of narcissism where instead of being yourself in a place that you are not, you actually are basically pretending to be someone else, not that kind of over-identification, but actually a practice of imagination where you are yourself in a place where you are not.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, so now that we're talking about comedy and art, I thought we could go into some more specifics about some of the examples, because you use many, many examples, and they're all very, yes, they're all very illustrative and evocative. And so what I thought I would ask you to do maybe is slightly unfair, but only slightly, which is maybe you could say a little, maybe you'd pick one of the examples about of comedy that you used to just begin with that. And maybe you say a little bit about it, how it builds your point, but also maybe if you could compare it to American comedy as a way of comparing and contrasting what's going on. Because, I don't know much about Syria at all, but I know more about American comedy and the state of American comedy. At least if you see, think of the late night talk shows, they're very political in a maybe you could say a kind of tribal way. That is that they're, the Stephen Colbert, the Jon Stewart is, it's not disruptive. It's already preaching to the choir, as it were. So I don't know if there are examples in America that are comparable, or if this is maybe more of a straightforward contrasting case.
Oh, no, I think there are lots of comparable examples, actually, and maybe the content is different. And you point out an important part and in some ways a danger of comedy, that there's a great deal of, and this is salutary, solidarity that can be induced through laughter. But there is also the danger of a kind of in-group joke that leaves too many people out, or the wrong people out, or defines the wrong and the right in a way that is deeply problematic for democratic action. But there are a number of comedies in the Syrian case that I think would be easily translatable, or I hope they would be easily translatable. I have even captioned some of them for American audiences, where people can understand some of the power and also the limitations of the comedic form. And of course, there are multiple genres in comedy. I'll talk about one in particular. So in a context in which encounters with loss are really intensified by the devastating carnage, it was noteworthy to me that Syrians, particularly in the 2016-17 period, made efforts to produce fresh accounts of daily life with a kind of a ventriloquistic virtuosity. So young people, particularly but not exclusively men, were shifting away from the mockery that centered on the person of Bashar al-Assad, the leader, to exploring the sociological conditions and micro processes of neoliberal autocratic rule. So one of my favorite groups that did this produced a set of skits called Nekzi, which is a slang word from Idlib, meaning little poke, and which can be used, as it is in English, to connote poking fun. And it features folks, particularly one young man, Sumar Barish, from Sarak, of an area of Idlib known for its early demonstrations in 2011 and for its general history of activism. So he relocated to Turkey. I don't know him personally. He relocated to Turkey as regime bombings and warring Islamic-oriented militias vied for control. And they engaged in a variety of cultural activities, including showcasing the region's very well-known humor. And there is an episode that deals with the ambivalent middle, or the gray people, the Ramadiin, in a way that is especially trenchant. So the astute account of the gray people in this episode differentiates among four different kinds. There's the sleaze bag, the windbag or farter, the gecko, and the motherfucker. And the sleaze bag is a coward who doesn't get involved. He remains silent in front of thugs and is even scared of a mouse entering the room. He's a sympathetic character. The farter or windbag is like his namesake. He's silent but deadly. He hates al-Asad, but he hates lying. He's not lying, but he sees the presence of the regime as better than the destruction of the country. All of these people are recognizable. The gecko, he's a hypocrite whose mottled skin and patches of lost pigmentation imply the absence of a strong, solid position. These are people that are extraordinarily recognizable to any Syrian, and they're keenly brought to life in this monologue. And many of the Syrian opposition comedies, in the context of devastating loss and ongoing violence, take this form, particularly in the 2016-17 period. In Arabic, they call it stand-up, but it's technically not stand-up, but we can just think of it as a kind of monologic orientation towards the comedic. And it's just very, very clever. So that kind of monologue is very familiar to us in the United States. And although the sociological references might not be clear, we understand hypocrites, we understand consummate pretenders, we understand, you know, opportunists of one sort or another, the windbag and the sleaze bag, just as readily as someone in Syria would. So in these ways, I think much of the comedy is translatable, although it might not be as funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Saturday Night Live recently in the Trump era has in some ways tried to, you know, build these skits around major character types. I'm not sure if that's a good analogy. I don't know if you watch Saturday Night Live.
Yes, of course I do. And I watch a tremendous amount of Syrian, American comedy as well, in part to get a sense of similarities and differences, both in terms of genres, genre breaking efforts, and in terms of the way in which the content might be similar or different. And I think I do mention, I know I do in the book, but that the kind of ventriloquism that I talk about finds especially sophisticated expression in a YouTube video comedy series, sort of Over the Roofs is the best way to translate it into English, that a title that connotes something done in secret or indirectly. And the activists who perform in this series actually come from Ghouta on the outskirts of Damascus, which was the site of the chemical weapons attack of 2013, and they have done a remarkable job at demonstrating irreverence not only for the regime, but also for the organization and practices that have cropped up in areas under opposition control. And in one of the most noteworthy episodes, a young comedian enjoins the newly elected President Trump to borrow from Syria's authoritarian playbook in order to expedite the achievement of despotism in the United States. And that is an especially dark but funny episode, dark mm-hmm. and funny episode, I should say. Mm-hmm. So the Saturday Night Live, of course, has resources that these folks don't have. At this point, the kind of opposition comedies no longer involve big teams. They tended to have bigger teams at the beginning than they have now, but none of them were on the scale of something like Saturday Night Live. The puppet skits that I talk about at the towards the middle of the chapter when I begin around opposition comedy, translated into English as Top Goon, those finger puppet comedies, which are really quite wonderful and are subtitled in English, so available for anybody's viewership, those I think do appeal to global audiences. They're very, very well done. And again, they do not require an ensemble in quite the same way, but they also require a kind of technological know-how and operate in the form of the kind of skit that, say, Saturday Night Live is so expert in delivering.
Yeah, so maybe you could pick an example of of one of the artists that you talk about. You talk about a lot of different artists in the second half of the book, but maybe in chapter four, you talk about political judgment and the use of melodrama and sentiment among the artists. I didn't know if you have a favorite example of an artist there who expresses something illustrative about your point, and maybe same question. I mean, is this something translatable across to the United States? Do we have examples here that are comparable?
Yes, and in fact, many of these films that I mention, and again, I want to be clear, there are people who have devoted books to documentary filmmaking or to photographing the revolution or filming the revolution in ways that this book does not. This is not an encyclopedic account of filmmaking or the history of filmmaking. This is taking particular filmmakers who are not just used because their artifacts demonstrate sort of evidence, but rather because they are my interlocutors for thinking about a kind of political otherwiseness to authoritarian control and to the seductions of authoritarianism in a liberal democracy. And I mentioned Osama Muhammad's controversial Silvered Water, and that has gotten, it's been award-winning. It's also has a lot of controversy around the right of the image. There are other ones, though, as well, that are worthy of note. So one is Ziad Kulsum's The Immortal Sergeant, which is a really remarkable anthropological narrative, a film within a film, quite expansive. It opens with an oblique angle onto a scene of domesticity, depicting askew the world of reliable ordinariness. And the film reprises themes that actually are evident throughout the book, in that the central character, in this case, the director, is split. He's a conscripted sergeant housed in army barracks by night, but he works by day as a cameraman for the well-known art film director, Muhammad Mullas. He's also internally divided, evidenced by repeated images of division. We see sometimes a split screen, like a children's butterfly painting made by folding a piece of paper in half, as well as scenes shot professionally with a proper camera, juxtaposed ones shot surreptitiously on a handheld cell phone. And from the professional camera, we get footage of downtown Damascus, where a cast and crew of the fictional movie are filming on location, which offers us a window onto the world of quotidian work and artistic collaboration in wartime's disruptive circumstances. And from the cell phone, we get grainy, unstable, stealthily captured footage of military life, largely from a barracks on Mount Qasyun overlooking the capital, but also sometimes from unspecified areas of the country. And so the film is, among other things, a kind of multi-sided meta-narrative about filmmaking, by a director taking advantage of his jobs as both cameraman and soldier, resulting in an extraordinarily ethnographically rich, unusually prosaic and unsensational account of skewed ordinariness and the profound damage done by violence, even at a distance, to the people suffering it, and without over emphasizing the suffering. The problem some people point out with Silvered Water is that there is a kind of overemphasis on the suffering. But I think that that does a disservice to the richness also of Osama Muhammad's A Silvered Water, Ma' al-Fidda, Silvered Water, Syria Self-Portrait, which is also a study in the process of mourning, which we haven't talked about, my third term, and an avowal of cinema's evolving revolutionary capacities. And here, Jeff, you mentioned, again, Hannah Arendt. And she is very important to me here, in part because I think that Osama Muhammad's film does a remarkable job of producing a version of, or showing us how to practice representative thinking. So again, for Arendt, exercising this human capacity presupposes intersubjective relations of a sort that depend on political judgment. She does say something like, if the question is neither of empathy, as though I tried to be or feel like somebody else, nor of counting noses and joining a majority, but of being and thinking in my own identity, where actually I am not. This is, of course, what Immanuel Kant called an enlarged mentality. And the films that I talk about in the chapter, Osama Muhammad's being first and foremost among them, despite major political and aesthetic divergences from one another, mark the most, I think, sustained efforts at this kind of imaginative mode of judgment, this kind of representative thinking. In Kalthoum's, the earlier one I just spoke about, disagreement is portrayed in all its visual and cacophonous richness. And feelings of terror and boredom get mixed with viewpoints and giggles and crazy narrations and tears and charged silences. And the director's ultimate decision to defect facilitates the previously split participant observer's psychological reintegration. So that film is already doing that. But most dramatically, Osama Muhammad's meta-commentary on cinema's structural capacity to offer multiple perspectives and to envision dissonance as radical potential situates Osama Muhammad as director as a kind of representative thinker in his own right, putting him in various places where he is not, among protesters, amid the rubble in Homs, in the regime barracks, dancing Debke. In doing so, his film avowedly commits to the image, not so much to supply additional facts or evidence, but more to reveal what we already know by changing the meaning of what we see. So it's this kind of creative effort at otherwiseness through representative thinking that I see Syrian artists doing that give me a tremendous amount of, not hope, as Wendy Brown said in her podcast, I'm not the kind of person who is particularly hopeful, but a certain sense of, you know, optimism of the will, if you want.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to come to a close with a challenge and with a question about the broader applicability of your interpretation here. I mean, first the challenge. You mentioned at the beginning, I think, you wanted to offer your interpretation of the Bashar al-Assad rule in contrast to the more materialistic explanations that are offered by the social sciences, and so I just wanted to push you on that. I mean, I think the point you made at the beginning was that if it were all materialistic elements at play here, you wouldn't see so much attention to the more ideological elements, which is, I think, a fair enough point. but I think questions still remain. I think about in understanding Syria and the Syrian conflict. What's the status of some of the approaches, the economic approaches, say, in understanding serious conflict, the political approaches, and understanding, say, the international conflict that's being staged, say, between Russia and the West that goes on here. And then finally, the elements of religion, I think, that pop up here. I mean, I'm assuming that part of your explanation is those things are important too. It's just you're providing a kind of corrective, but maybe you could say a little bit about how you think about those alternative ways of understanding Syria and how they sort of work with and against your theory.
Yeah, so thank you. And I appreciate the opportunity to end on this note too. In political science, you know, as you were saying, Jeff, politics tend to be about material interests and the groups articulating them. And the studies, say, of authoritarian resilience have tended to privilege materialist claims, detailing, for example, how patronage is used to garner instrumental support, or how coercive mechanisms of control generate obedience. And it's not like I don't think those are important. I just think that ideology also matters. My work has always been centered on what I used to call the disciplinary symbolic modes of domination. So what I do, I think, is reject the sharp dichotomy between materialist and ideational approaches from the outset, and insist on an analysis that theorizes ideology as inscribed in material practices, to borrow again from Althusser. So in resisting the binary, this book in particular does something that my previous work didn't do. It presumes the unevenness of ideological reproduction. So it tackles head-on the complex forms of political attachment understood capaciously enough to describe both loyalty to the regime and a deep ambivalence toward it, as well as degrees of outright opposition. So if we think about the ambivalent middle, for example, some of those folks are wealthy, some of them are not. Some of them lived in places where fear was of paramount importance, some of them did not. When you do, and there is a, believe it or not, a quantitative appendix to my book, that is not something I did, that is something that Sophia Fenner did, and she gets full credit for it in the book. But one of the interesting aspects of the appendix is to show that despite political economy assertions that it was the economy, say, that generated or caused the uprising, or that fear was what kept people in their homes, one sees from the quantitative analysis, which has its own problems, that the pattern is that there was no pattern, at least if we think strictly in materialist terms. I want to think of my own orientation to ideology as not being ideational, however. I want to think about it as, again, in Althusserian terms, as ideas inscribed in material practices, where material practices also have symbolic effects, and where symbols are affectively laden.
Good. I mean, that's helpful to think of it as not an either or, because one of the things I was thinking of when you were talking earlier about comedy and so forth is, if you're thinking from the perspective of an agent of resistance, it's all well and good to have comedy, but you also want economic resources, military power, et cetera, in order to resist. But your point is, it's not, it shouldn't be either or, right? I mean,
correct,
that resistance to authoritarian regimes requires both. And yeah, say
resistance
something like
to anything requires both.
Right.
Indeed, even thinking about institutions, it's not just that it requires both, that although we can think of these as analytically distinct, they are in practice co-implicating, indeed dialectically related to one another. So that one cannot think the institution of schooling, for example, without understanding or having some idea about pedagogy. One cannot think about the institutions of coercive control without having some understanding of punishment. So that these things are maybe analytically separable for certain kinds of purposes, but actually are deeply imbricated. And it's that imbrication that I want to speak to.
So last question, if I may, and unfortunately it's a big one, but which is the question, I always do this, just drop a, you know, throw a grenade.
A bomb show at the end.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's the question about, I mean, that I sort of anticipated already at the beginning, which is the sort of broader applicability of this notion of authoritarian apprehension that you're developing here. Can we learn something from the experience of Syria that we can apply profitably to other regimes, authoritarian perhaps, or non-authoritarian, say in the case of thinking of Viktor Orban in Hungary with the development of illiberal democracy, or elsewhere, or in Russia, or something like that? Or is this really idiosyncratic to Syria? Can we draw broader lessons about authoritarianism beyond this country?
It is absolutely not idiosyncratic to Syria, which isn't to say that Syria doesn't have specificity. But one of the reasons that this interested me as a topic in Syria was such a rich place to think with and through and with Syrians of many different political stripes has to do with the ways in which many of the insights I derived from living in Syria over many years and meeting so many different kinds of Syrians was the portability of many of the themes to what is happening in the world more broadly. So this is not even about neoliberal autocracy, as broad a set of so-called cases that would enable us to think about China, Vietnam, Russia, for example. But liberal democracy seems to be unmaking itself in the United States and parts of Europe. And we find civil rights being curtailed and forms of ultra-nationalist populism. You just mentioned Hungary emerging with little regard for due process or press freedoms. So this isn't simply something that is specific or peculiar about Syria. And it is something that we as political theorists need to take seriously. You know, if pundits, hailed the end of history and political scientists promoted theories of democratic transition in the 90s, the early 2000s already saw a shift in attention towards authoritarian retrenchment and studying authoritarian retrenchment. We saw this in studies of electoral backsliding, elite rivalries, undemocratic power sharing, variations in economic development and growth, inequality, and an attention to institutional fragilities produced by colonial and imperial forms of social control. But the current moment is, I think, rightly generating reinvigorated interest in authoritarianism as such, and bringing us new accounts of phony elections and party co-optation, as well as nuanced concern for coercive apparatuses, the evisceration of the free press in certain instances, the problems that social media brings to our collective attention. And scholars, whether you're thinking about liberal democracy or alt-right movements or nationalism in Eastern Europe, scholars find themselves wondering with some urgency why it is that authoritarianism seems to appeal to citizens, why it's not only autocrats who are attracted to autocracy, but the ordinary citizenry as well. And that's what this book is really trying to deal with. Thinking about attraction, not simply as wholehearted loyalty, but enough buy-in to reproduce the circumstances of authoritarian rule, the kind of I know very well and yet nevertheless of our current situation.
Well, Lisa, wonderful book and great conversation, and I really appreciate you joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.